how MoviePass makes money. Cobalt in iPhone batteries, the creator of the yoga emoji, the researcher who discovered the Tesla cryptojacker, and at long last, the twit switches over and I get my iPhone back. All that and so much more coming right up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 20, recorded Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to the show. This is the place where every week we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. All kind of sort of ready to hand over the watch to you. We'll talk about that later.
Yes, we will. So let's talk about water cooler conversation. Around the office, I have noticed that ours is trending more towards movies still in the theater and away from Netflix.
Oh.
And this could be due in no small part to MoviePass, a new subscription service that lets you see one movie every day for as many days of the month as you'd like for a monthly fee. Along with some of our office mates, our guest today is also a fan of MoviePass and looked into the service. Welcome, Eric Newcomer, reporter at Bloomberg News.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So far you say you've paid MoviePass exactly $9.95.
Exactly. Yeah, I think my qualifications here are I'm a super avid MoviePass fan. No. It's a monthly service you subscribe. And I think they even lowered it after I subscribed to $7.95 if you paid sort of for a year. And then you can go to a movie every day. So I went to like six in less than a month. You know, I'm getting tweets from people who are like, oh, I'm trying to go every day. You know, there's people are sort of binge movie watching with this subscription service.
So were you going to the theater before? I know you said that the Movie Pass is taking you away from Netflix, Overwatch, and Audible, like any good professional millennial. But were you actually going to the movies before at all?
Yeah, I mean, I'd go for sort of event screenings, you know, like a Friday night with friends. You know, I saw The Post, which was somewhat bigger movie. But I don't think I would have gone to see, you know, Phantom Threat, billboards, you know, movies like that that aren't as big budget that maybe you could normally wait to see if they come on HBO or Netflix. And now it's sort of like, oh, why not? You know, if I'm just going to, you know, binge watch some stupid TV show on Netflix, I could just sort of go to the movies, take an Uber and, you know, see something for free.
I have to imagine with something that is kind of all you can eat or all you can view, like MoviePasses, there's some set of restrictions. Are you limited to like premiere nights, or are there any restrictions that kind of come along with this?
So you can't see 3D, you can't see IMAX, and you have to basically book it when you get there. You have to, you open the app, you activate this debit card, then you use the debit card. And so, you know, I went to see Black Panther over the weekend and I purchased those tickets in advance. So I didn't use MoviePass for that, you know. So it's really for the, especially in a city situation where, you know, you think you can buy the movie when you show up, movie ticket when you show up.
Wow. So talk a little bit about the economics of this, which don't make any sense to me.
They don't make any sense. I mean, I think the strategy for monetization is sort of threefold. One, you know, they want to make money off sort of data and analytics. So we can figure out what people want to go to, maybe help movie theaters plan marketing campaigns, et cetera. So that's one. Two is negotiating a cut of ticket sales so that basically they can offer these at a discount to chains like AMC. And then three, similarly, get a cut of concession sales. And basically the idea is, you know, we drive you business and you give us sort of a discount. And I think that's a pretty sort of traditional business. And that terrifies movie theaters that they might be forced to, you know, pay movie pass to drive them business.
So how? Yeah. So right now they're not being forced. Right now they're not getting any sort of cut from the concessions and giving
right.
any.
So now they're just burning. It's, you know, it's a classic startup. Let's burn a lot of money, make this catch on, prove that there's a demand for it, and then hope that, you know, after we've, you know, spent sort of tons of money subsidizing the service, the economics start to make sense because we've bootstrapped our way into sort of leverage against the movie theaters. And right now there's this big fight with AMC. AMC sort of CEO insisted that we're never going to give MoviePass a cut. MoviePass pulled its service from some cities with some AMC theaters, but not all. And so we're seeing those sort of negotiations happen right now.
Prior to MoviePass, because it sounds like you've been a long time movie lover, so I'm sure you've been to the movie theater plenty of times before. I used to work in a movie theater, so I know from my time then is that, you know, the theater itself isn't making any money off the tickets. They're making the money off the concessions. You, as, you know, someone who has gone many times within a month on MoviePass, I mean, has that increased your spending at the concession stand, or
yeah,
are you just
roll
in there, you don't care about the food because
you're
doing this all the time?
I'm a terrible sort of anecdote for them there because, you know, I'm trying like low carb New Year's, so I'm like not buying yeah. popcorn, so I'm a terrible customer on the concessions front. So it's sort of fun as a customer just to, you know, literally not spend a dollar when you get there. In my newsletter, when I wrote about this, sort of argued, you know, they need to try to, you know, that you could imagine a world where Uber has to pay a cut and the local restaurant has to pay a cut, because basically they're trying to bundle together this like go out experience rather than, okay, I'm going to sit at home and, you know, make my own food and watch some streaming service. So, you know, I sort of envision, you know, other sort of ways I'm spending money that MoviePass could presumably try and get a cut of, but they're not getting money from concessions on me right now.
Right.
It's really too bad that low-carb New Year's coincides with the time when completionists such as yourself are trying to see every Academy
exactly.
Award.
Exactly. It's a terrible combination for them, yeah.
Yeah, it really should come in the holiday season when everyone's eating whatever they want.
Right.
So is there you said one of the biggest risks is that MoviePass is going to run out of money. Is there a chance that they're going to get run out of money?
I mean, we don't have a lot of visibility into it. You know, I think it's... I haven't done a great back of the envelope, but, you know, if it only costs $10 a month and one ticket in San Francisco costs $13, and so I've spent somewhere of $80 of their money, they're down $70. Like, that sounds like a pretty dangerous business model until you can get sort of other forms of cash flow. And clearly, because, you know, as we're having this conversation, it's grown much more visible and popular. I think they last said they had 2 million customers. So, you know, growth in a money-losing operation can be a bad thing because you're just burning more and more money a month. So they're going to have more leverage with more customers, but sort of more pressure on their balance sheet with more money-losing customers.
In the world of technology, we're very used to this idea that when it comes cheap or, you know, free or whatever, you know, chances are you are the... you are the currency.
Right.
Your data
yeah.
is at heart.
Right.
What do you know about MoviePass and kind of its data practices on people that are using it?
I mean, I you know, people have complained that the terms and services sort of change with some frequency. I haven't scrutinized them too closely, but clearly the idea is, you know, you participate and we can sort of see what your movie going habits are. That, to me, doesn't seem that terrifying, given that that's already what, you know, a Netflix is trying to do. So, you know, I think there's that information, and that's something that you might not get sort of in the movie business. But yeah, I think, you know, it's just sort of the classic sort of digital age sort of data monitoring for the physical world, which we've seen attempts, you know, from everything from, you know, malls trying to track people's cell phones to figure out if it's the same customer. There have been all these different ways to bring sort of Minority Report style tracking to the real world that we've grown accustomed to in online businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So have you heard any rumors of any big companies possibly buying them, like Netflix or one of the big movie companies?
Or Uber.
Or Uber.
Well, you know, I think I think that, so they're sort of majority owned now by this sort of data analytics publicly sort of traded company, though very small, Helios and Matheson, I think is what it's called. I have no idea, you know, no information on any sort of acquisition or sort of exit strategy there. I think, you know, other people have written that there's, you know, a logic to, you know, a player like Netflix getting into the movie business, whether, you know, movie passes the path, you know, who knows, you know, you could see somebody else trying to do this themselves, but I mean, hard to match the gumption of MoviePass right now, just offering the service at such a discount to gain is, you know, in a land grab, basically.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us. Eric Newcomer is a reporter at Bloomberg on Twitter. He is Eric Newcomer. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
You're a brave soul, taking it for the team, saving a lot of money and going to the movie theater.
Now I'll go see Call Me By Your Name. You know, I need to get the last off.
Yes. Do it. Be the completionist that you are. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right, feedback time. Todd wrote in about our segment on the HomePod teardown. That was the iFixit interview we had last week. Todd said, could you please stop wasting perfectly good airtime on worthless subjects? I've seen plenty of TV repair stores, appliance repair stores, etc., but not one speaker repair store. He says, geez, no one repairs a speaker. Otherwise, there would be speaker repair stores. Oh, and stop trying to pull out the cord. It's hard to remove for a reason. It's not designed to be removable.
I like your energy, Todd.
Yeah, I appreciate that too.
Our next guest is actually going to talk a little bit about this because he did study a lot about how difficult Apple makes things to repair. It's not, I totally agree with you. I guess there are, Burke saying there are speaker repair stores? Burke used to be in charge of repairing speakers and
at a speaker repair store.
So different kind of repair store, but it's more than just a speaker. I mean, there's a lot of technology inside, and understanding it and figuring out how easy it is to, you know, to take apart, possibly fix if you need, I think is worthy information. But I also really appreciate you taking the time to write us, Todd.
Yeah, maybe not even just repairing. Sometimes it's just neat to see what kind of engineering and effort goes inside of a piece of technology that we're not meant to see. I personally, that kind of fascinates me, to kind of deconstruct some of this technology and really understand the engineering feats that are happening underneath.
I'm more concerned about the PETH aspect, the people for the ethical treatment of HomePods.
Oh, that. Yes. I understand.
Cobalt is all the rage these days as demand for batteries in cars and phones increases. Reuters reported that cobalt prices on the London Metal Exchange have quadrupled since 2016. And now sources tell Bloomberg that Apple wants to buy cobalt directly from miners to save money. Joining us to talk about this and other Apple intricacies is Mark Bramhill, a lifelong Apple enthusiast, an independent radio producer, and creator of the popular podcast Welcome to Macintosh. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Pleasure to be here.
So the final episode of season two of Welcome to Macintosh is all about the cost of us wanting the latest and greatest Apple products. Tell us what you learned a little bit about the minerals inside Apple products.
Yeah, you know, there's a ton of different elements and minerals that go into making each of the devices that are in our phone, like all of our phones, our laptops. You know, the majority of these materials can't actually be regained and reused through recycling. We're actually pretty bad at recovering a lot of these materials. And so this is something where I don't think most people are really aware of the large impact that this has. And I know that I personally have found it like challenging as I've learned more about these things to feel as purely optimistic and positive about always upgrading to the latest and greatest.
I've just started listening to your podcast, and it's so great. I mean, it's very different from what we do. It's very edited, and you know, it's like a story. And I mean, it is a story, a well-told true story. And you tell the story about how you waited in line for the first iPhone, and I think your freshman year of high school. But then you did mention that you do have that voice in your head that says, "Oh, I need this. I need the iPhone 10." Is getting quieter, and you don't have the iPhone 10. How did you quiet that voice?
I mean, it's something where I still very much want one, but it's something where it's just a slow progression where I think, you know, being able to appreciate the even like an iPhone like 6 or a 7, like those are still amazing devices, and I think being able to kind of just step back a little bit and appreciate like how good a thing is beyond the point where like something better is announced, that doesn't make the thing you have less good or less enjoyable, I think. So it's definitely something where I struggle with it as well. And I expect that I will probably still upgrade more than like the average person. But it's definitely something where being a little more intentional and thoughtful about it, I think, can be really important.
Yeah, so I'm on the Android side. I mean, when Megan and I aren't switching platforms like we have for the last 6 weeks, we'll talk about that in the next segment. At least I know from experience, and maybe both of you can kind of talk to this a little bit on iOS, but I know through Android and my experience with a lot of Android devices is that it can be really good and fully, I mean, it can be a great phone when compared, you know, to phones from 3, 4, 5 years ago or whatever. But there is a point is it 1 year? Is it a year and a half where things kind of start to be less efficient? Things start to slow down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are other reasons to kind of upgrade to these phones. Like the previous iPhone might not have, you know, might not be a bad phone necessarily, and the new phones might have these extra bells and whistles, but there are other reasons to upgrade too. Do you feel that on the iOS side? Like, does that play into the decision around feeling like you have to have the latest and greatest? Because quite frankly, the newest one is going to perform better for you than anything. And is that really that important?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the latest battery kerfuffle that Apple's had about then slowing down, throttling older iPhones when their battery health degrades. And that's something where like, or just even general slowness as operating system updates are released and they're not optimized for older hardware. That's definitely an issue that I think people have. I definitely have noticed that, my phone is slower on year 2 or 3 or 4, than it was when I first got it. Though for certain things, I think like with the battery thing, Apple has been doing much better with their, discounted, battery replacements that they've been offering. And you know, with, guides and kits from places like iFixit, then you're able to do that kind of repair yourself. It's actually for the iPhone battery, not too difficult. It's something where there's not a whole lot you can do when the operating system is really not optimized well for your device. Mm-hmm. But if it's something along the lines of the battery health is lessened and degraded over use or something like that, like that's a thing which, with a little bit of time and effort, you can actually fix. So I think putting in that energy and thought before just automatically being like, my phone seems a little slow, I'm going to go buy a new one today. Like sure. That's, I think for sure though, I definitely agree that there's a certain point where it's just like, okay, this is really slow running like any games or whatever. And if that's like at that point, then yeah, it can be worth upgrading. But then it's something where that phone is still something I think to try and keep in use, whether or not it's you using it or selling it or whatever, to try and have it being reused as long as possible. Mm-hmm.
So I know you spoke to Kyle Weens from iFixit. Well, tell us a little bit about what you learned about how and why Apple makes it so difficult to fix so many of the products.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's hard to talk about intention on that, just because Apple is a little, they're known for their secrecy. So, but it's something where a lot of times it comes down to priorities. Like, I don't think it's a usually nefarious, super nefarious thing. I think the things like the Pentalobe screws that they switched to with the iPhone 4, that is something which is a little more on the explicitly wanting to keep users from repairing their own devices, where, you know, the reasons for that could be from they don't want you to fix it at all, on the most cynical side, and they want you to just buy a new device, or on the where I think it's maybe somewhere in the middle of towards Apple wants to be the one to do the repairs, or Apple authorized retailers rather than having users do it. I personally think that anyone should be able to open up and try and repair a device that they own. But then towards the other end of things, like with something like the amounts of glue and things that they use for holding in batteries in iPads, and with the latest lines of MacBook and MacBook Pro, for those, I think any comments or things that Apple has said about that, I don't remember exactly where this came from, but the basic idea would be that by using glue rather than housing, it adds structural integrity to the devices, which allows them to be slightly thinner, or the lack of housing itself also allows it to be a tiny bit thinner. But, you know, that's something where that really makes it almost impossible to recycle this massive block of aluminum, where that's like normally like that's a very recyclable material that should be something that's easy to recover. And this makes it something where it would be like a total waste of time or waste of money for a recycler to try to recover these things. So it's something where having the devices be a tiny bit thicker, or rethinking like, okay, how do we design around this, where it's a design problem, where Apple has incredible designers and a great, like a very competent design team. And I totally believe that they could find a good solution to this, with that, if it was a higher priority on the list, as opposed to thin and light and sleek, being above anything else.
Well, and thin, light, sleek, that's all fuel for, you know, buying a new device, like you're saying, instead of this idea of sustainability and repair, which I should also point out, Apple's been very vocal and they have efforts, you know, around sustainability, not only on a company level, but also on device specific, you know, some of their programs, also, you know, Liam, the recycling robots, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. So it's like they're playing both sides of the field in that regard. If they're gluing things to make for thinner devices, then they're really kind of cutting off a lot of potential on the back end. Or, you know, is Apple supporting like a good kind of trade-in, kind of secondhand market for a lot of these used phones, or are they relying on third parties in order to do that? Because that's probably where those devices end up.
Yeah, I don't know the exact details. I know Apple does allow for trade-ins. I don't know the exact details of what they do within that program, though.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a very vibrant third-party and independent reselling market for Apple products and iPhones, for sure.
Absolutely.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about emoji. There's the 157 new emoji in the 2018 mm-hmm. emoji list. So there's now 2,823 approved emoji, and you are the creator of one of those emoji. The yoga emoji.
You're famous.
Person in lotus position, yeah.
Okay, so there are other yoga emojis, but yours is person in lotus position?
It's just the one emoji for to represent yoga and or meditation. But the specific name, just because the Unicode organization that moderates all of these, then they they are very particular about the naming. They want to have specificity. So person in lotus position is better than the name of person doing yoga or person meditating, where that might leave a little more ambiguity in how different vendors would draw the emoji. So Apple might draw someone if it was just person doing yoga. You know, one platform might have someone doing like tree pose, and someone else might be doing lotus position. So that's the idea behind that.
So what inspired you to create the yoga emoji? Like, are you also a yoga enthusiast, or do you need to tell people to relax a lot in messages? Or
No. I personally am not much of a yoga person, or at least wasn't when I started it. I had been trying to learn more about the whole process, reached out to Jeremy Burge, the founder of Emojipedia, and was asking him like how the process worked, and learned while I was talking to him, oh, this is a thing that anyone can do. And was like, well, I have to do this now. So I asked him what do you think? Like, he gets requests all the time for things that people want. So I asked him, what do you think would be basically like, what's a shoe-in for a good emoji? Like, what do the people really want? And he was saying yoga or meditation would be a good bet. And so it's like, all right, I know nothing about this. It's, but I am taking this up as my cause.
Wow. And so explain how you take that up then. What is the next step? This is something that you don't necessarily practice. You just know that this thing doesn't exist in emoji yet. Like, mm-hmm. What do you do to make that happen?
Well, Jeremy helped point me in the right direction for all of that. So there's you have to submit a proposal to the Unicode Consortium, which is a standards body that regulates what text on how text is encoded on everyone's computers. For the first step, going through all of that, just like, there was I had to learn a little bit about yoga and meditation. And so I went to some local yoga places and asked people about like what are important, like what are the poses that you think would be representative and what would be important, and learned a little bit about that, and wrote up this document explaining why yoga would be a good emoji to have. There's a lot of different elements that you have to address for like, could there be multiple meanings for this? And so for yoga, like you said, it could be, for calm, like mental well-being. It could also be for representing the actual like practice of yoga. And so, or the idea of like Zen. So it's something where like, that it's not easily representable by other emoji that existed before it. Like it's not, this isn't a brand, and showing that there's people who use like the hashtag yoga on Instagram and Twitter more than hashtags of something similar like running, where there's already a running emoji. So proving that there's a likely demand and potential for usage. Those are some of the things that go into it.
Do you get a prize for creating an emoji, or is it just simple pride? That's my emoji.
Just the pride. You get to tell people that you were responsible for the character that's on their keyboard, and the pride of the fact that this thing that this little thing you did has impacted millions of computers and phones around the world.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, what if someone was just like really, really tense, like at the end of their rope, and then somebody texted them the lotus person in lotus position? You might have saved a life.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I can't say I know that that has happened. But I can't say that I don't know.
There is a non-zero chance.
Now, if you want to listen to Mark's full story of his great emoji adventure, you can subscribe to Welcome to Macintosh. It's available everywhere you can download podcasts. And also, if you want to support Welcome to Macintosh, Mark did not ask me to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway because it is a really great podcast. Season 3, you can still join your Kickstarter for that, right?
Sorry, the Kickstarter for that actually is just going to be for another season. We'll be starting soon, but if people want to, then keep an eye out for that in the coming weeks.
Awesome, thank you, Mark. Mark Ramhill, right. Host of Welcome to Macintosh. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk to you soon. All right, the day has finally come, Megan. Roughly 6 weeks ago, Megan and I embarked on a most excellent adventure. As we traded our prized possessions with each other, Megan handed over her iPhone 10. I handed over my Pixel 2 XL. And then Megan surprised me with a 6-week deadline, two weeks longer than we did this last year. And I think we're both ready for just a little bit of normalcy to return to our lives. But before that happens, we got to talk a little bit about what we learned this time.
No, that was part of it.
Yeah, we got to talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
What did you learn, Megan?
I learned that I was more flexible. Speaking of yoga, I was more flexible than I thought I was, and certainly more flexible than last year. Like it sort of became pretty easy to use right away. And I don't blame Android for the problems I had. I do blame Apple's closed ecosystem, and I blame myself because you have to go in and physically sign out of iMessage. I didn't do that, so a lot of my messages were lost, and that was most frustrating thing. And then the not knowing if your messages were lost, and then you turn back into a teenager and you're like, did you text me? No, I didn't text you. That sort of thing made me feel very uneasy. I will really miss the camera a lot. It is a great camera. If you can bring up this, I just tweeted out a picture that I took basically in the same place in our house of my dog, and neither look great. They're on Twitter, but and you're probably watching them through another filter, but I think they together next to each other, they both look bad somehow. But the portrait mode in the Pixel 2 XL is pretty amazing. And when I looked at all the pictures that I've taken, that's what made me feel sad that I'm going to hand the phone back.
Well, and they're different, very different technologies doing this. On the iPhone 10, you've got the two cameras. And so that's actually able to kind of determine the differential between the two cameras and be able to say this, you know, that differential is what gets blurred out in the background, whatever. And on the Pixel 2, I mean, it's interesting that you feel like they're on par, because I would think that mechanically you would have an advantage in that sort of computational photography. But on the Pixel 2, I mean, it's all Google and their artificial intelligence, you know, going to work on this photo and determining what's in the foreground and what's in the the background. And they've even rolled out some updates to the hardware, or to the software running on that particular hardware, that improves that. So
yeah, and it is a great camera. Over the weekend, Leo and I spoke to someone from DP Reviews, an expert scientist, about the computational photography and the difference. And he also prefers the Pixel 2 XL. I mean, he said they're both, for their own reasons, you know, they have advantages. But like in terms of a smartphone camera, the Pixel 2 wins on that. So I also have this bag of, before I hand over the phone, I have this bag of garbage.
Oh, okay. A junk
you can
bag.
Open that.
Go ahead and open this.
That's
see
a,
here. We've got
a
some
bunch of chargers.
I didn't give these to you.
No, those are actually from Florence Ion. Florence lent me two smartwatches.
Those chargers.
Two Android watches. Oh, and yeah.
This
and
is my old case.
No, you didn't have a case.
Didn't I? Oh, no, that's right. I had a case on the Pixel. I had to buy that case. My first, okay.
Yeah.
So thanks for that.
And then, that watch that's almost as big as my head.
Yeah, this is a big watch.
And the battery never lasted throughout the day.
LG Sport, I believe. LG Watch Sport. Something like that. Yeah, I'm not probably going to wear that.
Then, yeah.
Then we've got the charger for the LG Watch Sport. Mm-hmm. We've got the LG Style, or is that what it is?
Yeah, the LG Style.
LG Style, that's Florence's. I'll make sure she gets that. And then this, which I will definitely wear because of all the bling. Michael Kors.
Sophia, the Michael Kors Sophia, which doesn't have real diamonds on it.
Hey, you want to buy a watch?
Yeah.
Want to buy a watch?
So those all failed.
Yeah. So you just didn't enjoy the wear experience.
No, the battery didn't last. And then when the battery goes out, you had to repair it. It was a pain. I didn't willingly give up my Apple Watch because last year you barely wore it. You don't like watches. So I wasn't even going to mention the watch. I was trying to MacGyver my Apple Watch to work with the Android phone. And I got a lot of things to work those first couple weeks. And then Florence had to come and rain on my parade and say, why didn't you give why didn't you give him the watch? Isn't he wearing the watch? And I was like, oh, do you want the watch?
Oh, I guess I gotta do that.
So the watch has only been gone for a month, but I miss that more than anything.
Yeah. You'll get it back. Yeah, I mean, it's been one of the shining moments in the past month that I've had it, is that I've actually been very eager to wear it, which, I mean, I went for a very long time without wearing any watch. And then Android Wear did the wearable thing, and I wore watches for a while and did the wear thing. And then I just kind of lost interest because I felt like I was being notified to death. Like, I don't need to be that close to all of my notifications. And so then I stopped wearing it. And then also just Android Wear, I just feel has, I mean, it's okay. People are happy. Some people are happy with it. I just felt after a while that I just kind of got bored with it. It wasn't really offering anything that I needed, and so I stopped. And then you gave me the Apple Watch, and yeah, I mean, I've been wearing this for the past month. I like the style of it. I like the kind of design of it is really solid. It just feels like a nice piece of hardware, you know, that I look forward to wearing. Drop it on the wireless charger at night. I don't know what I'm trying to figure out is, what is the real actual difference here? Is it that it's more tightly integrated with iOS, and I like that integration compared to what Wear is with Android? I feel like they do very similar things. They all do about the same thing. I just feel like there's a fit and finish to the Apple Watch experience that I feel personally is lacking on Android Wear. And I liked it this time around.
Plus, it's not round.
Well, and you know, that's been kind of something that you and I have gone back and forth on, where I've been really into the round, and I still like round. I think round is a great way to go, because let's face it, watches have been round and clocks have been round for a very, very long time. So I think it's good to have that option, but it hasn't bugged me that this is rectangular at all. Yeah, so that well, hasn't really gotten.
Because I think then it's easier to go, for your brain to go from here to here when it's, yeah, you know, it just is the same. It's a similar screen. And I mean, there's just a lot of that's the one of the big differences between iOS and Android, is that I know everyone makes fun of it. It just works, because it doesn't always work. Nothing always works every time. But you didn't have to set anything up. It just started recording your activity. Like, yeah, you never started a workout or anything like that. You know, you didn't have to do anything. You were just like, oh, look at that. It's tracking my steps.
Yep.
It is seeing how much I worked out. Because, like, I'm more, every time I do a workout, I set the workout. But you said you never even did that.
I never even did that. And we talk a little bit about this on today's episode of Know How. We go into detail on kind of like the app experience and everything. So if you want more details, you can check that out. But yeah, absolutely. The quantified self stuff, the data that I never have really cared that much about. I found when I actually jumped into the apps on the iPhone that kind of track that stuff, I was really impressed with the detail, kind of the level of clarity that it gives you on that. I don't know what I do with that information, I guess, is the question that I have. But it's interesting to know that I have access to it. And definitely, you know, the I don't know if you can see on the watch, the circles thing. I don't know what that's called.
But the rings.
The rings.
Your activity,
there we go.
Rings.
Over time, I kind of learned what those were all about. And it was interesting to kind of go back and know that when I was wearing the watch, that information was being generated, and to kind of, you know, determine, hey, Thursday was a good day. What did I do on Thursday? What did I do at 1 o'clock? Oh, that's right. I went to the dog park and chased my dog around. It was just kind of an interesting way to look at things that you kind of take for granted your everyday life. Mm-hmm. You know, thought it did a good job. Gestures, I thought, were pretty much second nature. That's something you learn really quick on the iPhone 10, because it doesn't have the home button. So you have to kind of learn the gestures and how to swap between apps in a multitasking sort of way, which once a user pointed that out, I used it nonstop, never had a complaint going forward. So that was great. Face unlock, of course, it has the hardware at the top for face unlock. One thing I really liked about that is when I've got my notifications hanging out, you know, you have that little lock up at the top, but if you stare at it for a second, that will unlock. And those notifications that were before just obscured and just said like ring, once your face is recognized, it will give you all of the information of those notifications. You might see, instead of just that you got a text message, you'll see who it was from and what the text message was. It automatically reveals. I've noticed on Android devices like Samsung that has the face unlock feature or iris unlock feature, instead of that, it will just go, great, you're in, and it'll take you to your home screen. And it's like, well, but I still want to see what was in my notifications there. I couldn't see it before, and now it unlocked automatically and jumped me to my home screen. Maybe that's a setting that I could determine, but I like the way that they do that on iOS. Mm-hmm. Felt like it was the right way to do it.
And a lot of people commented that we never talked about the Samsung smartwatch either, like the Gear 360.
The Gear S3.
Or S3.
Yeah, the Samsung Gear S3 is the watch that I think a lot of people are, you know, it's Tizen. It's not Android Wear.
Right. So we didn't cover that this year. Maybe next year.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have that watch, so I couldn't give it to you, you know, but a lot of people are very pro Gear S3 as far as that's concerned. Trying to think of things that we haven't already talked about. I kind of gave up on Siri, to be honest. Like, I stopped, like, thinking I should check Siri for this, and because I just half the time wasn't getting what I wanted out of Siri. I didn't spend as much time this time around with the camera. And I think it's interesting that you pointed out that you love the camera on the Pixel. I'm trying to figure out, like, if there's some similarity in my reason for not using the camera here. I think the camera is great. I just really didn't play around with it very much. I thought I was going to mess around with it more. Maybe my life is just not as camerable right now.
Good. But, yes. Stop and slow down. Take photos.
Yeah. Apparently I do. Of course, I was sick for a week of the six weeks that we did this. So I wasn't taking any pictures for that week. But overall, you know, I think we talked about this also a little bit earlier. It's adaptability. Like, it's very easy for me to drop into iOS now. I'm very happy that we did this last year and this year, because I no longer can hide behind the fact that I don't understand how iOS works because I've never used it. I feel really comfortable with it now. It's not my preferred platform. I prefer Android, but I'm happy to know iOS on a deeper level, and that's what we get out of doing this. Do we switch back now?
Yeah.
Is it time?
I guess we do.
Is it time? Of course, we'll have to wipe things, you know, the data and stuff.
And my germs, probably, too.
Probably, but that's okay, because I have it back. Oh, Pixel, I have you back. Oh, this is what
we
it's
joke,
like to
though,
hold the Pixel.
But, I said this on Know How, too. it's just a phone.
Yeah, exactly. It is. We're so used to our own platform, but really, when it boils down to it, does it do the things you want it to do? Yes, both. Both phones make calls, both phones receive text messages, allow you to surf the internet, and install pretty much identical apps. It's just different ecosystems, and that's probably the big part of that. So, cool. Next year, are we doing another one?
Yes, 4 weeks next year. I'm sorry. Or however long you want to do it next year.
Oh, I get to pick.
Yeah.
All right. Looking forward to that. All right, up next, cryptojacking and what that term means for Tesla, of all companies. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience hasn't really been keeping up with the times, getting into the digital age. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or even refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. You get all these different options based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and then help you find the one that's just right for your specific scenario. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. During that ad, Megan and I both independently could not help but pick up our phones and be like,
"Well, because I
got
saw
my phone back."
I saw in the chat room that Scooter X says double tapping the power button on the Pixel 2 launches the camera.
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Oof. Oh yeah, it does. Oh, I remember that feature.
Because that was one of my weird complaints, because you couldn't, when you were looking at a picture, you couldn't just go back and forth as easily as you can. But thanks.
There you go.
Remind me next year, please.
Yeah, next year. Cryptojacking is a relatively new kind of security threat, and even a company like Tesla isn't immune to it. Researchers at RedLock, which is a cloud monitoring and defense company, discovered and published the details of a cryptojacking campaign targeting Tesla. And we have RedLock CTO Gaurav Kumar on the line to talk about their findings. Welcome, Gaurav.
Welcome. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's great to have you here. Thank you for joining us. So why don't we kind of take a step back first and foremost and start with cryptojacking at its core. What is that exactly? Explain it a little bit.
Sure. Cryptojacking is a new kind of an attack, as you just mentioned. What happens in this kind of attack is that attacker is exploiting the computing resources of the victim to do crypto mining. As we have seen in the last couple of months or maybe last couple of years, the price of cryptocurrencies have really skyrocketed. So it makes it really very lucrative for the attackers to just do this crypto mining to gain financial, just gain some money out of it. So it's just very easy.
And there's a lot of money to be gained there, I have to imagine. You also need a lot of resources. You guys head the cloud, you head the cloud security intelligence research team with RedLock. So talk a little bit about the hack itself. What exactly did you discover here? How did you communicate that with Tesla? What was the response there?
Yeah, sure. The charter of the CSI team, the Cloud Security Intelligence team, is to find out the misconfigurations on the internet, and especially when it comes to public cloud. We have so far discovered many such misconfigurations, and one of the misconfigurations is in a software called Kubernetes. So what we found out is that we found a server which was running Kubernetes. It's just a software. It was badly configured, and we could see the credentials of some customer. We didn't know that who this customer is. And we did some investigation, and we found out, oh, wow, it actually belongs to Tesla. We also observed that there was something interesting running on this server. And when we looked into it, we found that, oh, actually, this server is doing crypto mining. Which was very weird. Like, why would Tesla actually do crypto mining?
Right.
So on further investigation, we found that, oh, it's actually a compromised server. The attacker basically exploited a vulnerability, and now they are doing crypto mining.
Since you mentioned Kubernetes, we should, full disclosure, say that Google Cloud Platform is one of our sponsors. But I have a question about, is there any sense that they did anything besides cyber cryptojacking? Did they steal any other data? Do we know?
It's hard to tell. They might have. We did see credentials, the AWS cloud credentials are there on the console. So it's likely the attacker may have done something else too. However, Tesla has confirmed that it was non-private. It was just engineering data. It was related to some telemetry of cars. I think Tesla can better confirm that. As far as we know, at least crypto mining was going on.
Yeah, and you're talking about password protection or lack thereof. So is that Tesla setting up this instance improperly? Like, when you follow the breadcrumbs back, who does that lead to?
Yes, actually. So this server was not configured from a security perspective. To begin with, there was no reason for this server to be available out there on the public internet. It was publicly accessible. It shouldn't have been. And even if it was, then it should have been password protected. So, this is one of the challenges that, with the cloud, you do get a lot of speed. It's very agile. It's very easy to launch these servers. But then, security is considered as a friction. So we don't know what exactly went wrong, but at least we know that it was a misconfiguration.
Right.
So maybe this is too complicated to answer in the time that we have, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Like, as a lay person, it's confusing to me because there's nothing that I have, anything that I have, any of the devices I have, most of them anyway, it's very difficult to not put a password on them. You know, my iPhone, for example, like I have to go to great lengths to say, no, I don't want a password. For sure, I don't. That's not how this works, right? I mean, is it very easy to not add a password? Is that complicated for them?
It's not, actually. And what we have seen in the last couple of years is that many softwares out there don't have secure defaults, like Hadoop clusters and even like MongoDBs and Redis servers. All these servers have been built in a way that, oh, we will get you up and running very quickly. So they don't have secure defaults. And this is what happens many a times is that, oh, yeah, we need this server. Let's just launch it. We will worry about security later.
Interesting. So obviously crypto mining requires a lot of resources. Yes. Electrical cost, it can be pretty large when you're talking about crypto mining. But you had mentioned that this was relatively obscured because it resided on that corporate cloud infrastructure. Is corporate cloud infrastructure a common target for this particular sort of thing for crypto mining for that very reason?
So I would say public cloud, because corporate cloud can mean two things. Corporate cloud can be running on-premise, and it can be running on the cloud. Cloud is indeed a very interesting target for the attackers because it's virtual. You basically get virtually unlimited compute resources. And this is what we have observed, is that attackers are actually going after public cloud. And we have seen in the past that people are putting misconfigured, insecure software out there. So from an attacker perspective, it's awesome because, hey, you know, it's very easy to just compromise the server because it doesn't even have a password. There's actually nothing to compromise to begin with. And once you compromise, then you can launch as many instances as you want and do crypto mining, depending upon the, again, security configuration.
So, I mean, the Bitcoin, as far as I hear in the news, the Bitcoin market is so volatile. Is it really more profitable? Is this really more profitable than just old-fashioned identity theft?
It becomes profitable if you talk about unlimited compute resources. Like, if you are, from a crypto jacking perspective, if you just compromise, like, one machine, I don't think so anybody's going to make any money out of it. But it's all about the scale. You know, I mean, we have seen a month ago or so, there was a browser plugin, which was actually doing crypto mining on the browsers. And a lot of systems were infected. So it's not just one machine. You have to really compromise a large number of machines for it to be effective.
So Salon, the online newspaper Salon, and other places are now saying that they're offering that as an option to people. Crypto mine, let me use your resources in crypto mine instead of if you want to continue using your ad blocker. Is there any security danger to that? I mean, we do hear a lot about, you know, this nefarious crypto mining. Is that dangerous to let a website, if they've disclosed it, use your resources for crypto mining?
I would personally say, yes, it is dangerous because today they are doing crypto mining, but what is preventing them from doing something else? More importantly, what if that organization which is giving you the service, it gets compromised? And what if the attackers can launch something more malicious through this as an attack vector? So it's effectively telling, you know, hey, run this software and we will pay you some money, but you don't know what that software is doing. What is preventing that software from stealing your passwords or credit card numbers?
Absolutely. Gaurav, it's a pleasure talking with you. We really appreciate you guys doing the research that you do. Redlock.io. Is that where you want people to kind of follow all your work online?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Gaurav Kumar from Redlock, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for your
Take
time.
Take care. Okay. Best of luck with the research.
Thank you.
And finally, when Boston Dynamics shows off, I don't know about you, but I will always be there to marvel at the future, followed closely by fear of the robot uprising. This video is no different. In a video labeled Testing Robustness, we see the Spot Mini robot that kind of looks like a headless yellow robot dog trying its hardest to walk toward a door, open it by the door handle, and pry it open enough to walk through. Only, even though it's fully capable of this complex task, a human is standing next to it with a hockey stick being, well, a jerk. He's hitting the claw away from the doorknob. He's pushing the door closed before the Spot Mini can get a firm grasp of it. He's pulling the sad robot by the tail to move it away from the door so it so desperately wishes to escape through. However, you should know that in the end, the Spot Mini gets its way. It walks through the door taskfully, if not a little bit slowly, the way it will do when that guy is fast asleep in his bed some night in the not too distant future. All I'm saying is, hey, guy, you best check yourself before Boston Dynamics wrecks yourself. This dog's coming for you.
Did you have to say that?
I have to say it.
All I have to say is PEVBD.
What's that?
People for the Ethical Treatment of Boston Dynamics Robots. PEVBD.
For as long as Boston Dynamics is still around. Do you think the Boston Dynamics robots will outlive Boston Dynamics itself?
I think they'll probably outlive all of us.
That's probably true. Scary, but true. Tech News Weekly. We record live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. By the way, Twit Flash Briefing is available in Canada now, Australia, the UK, and India. It's been in the U.S. for a long time now. So if you are in any of those areas, you should sign into your Amazon or app and go to the settings. And under Flash Briefing, look for Twit. You'll find us there.
And we still have our yearly survey. It's still up. So we still want to hear from you so we can serve you better. Head over to twit.tv/survey. If you haven't already, just head over there. It doesn't take very long. And basically, our advertisers want to know a little bit more about you in aggregate. So not you specifically. We're not asking like what you had for breakfast or anything like that. So if you have just a couple minutes, it would be great if you could do that. And if you have a couple more minutes, it would be great if you could subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. And if you have a couple more minutes, It would be wonderful if you could tell someone who loves technology to also subscribe. And if you have even more minutes, tweet at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
We're asking a lot of you, but we love you. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to everyone here who's helping out, Jammer B, Burke, Josh, everyone who's helped out today. And thanks to you for joining us for another week of Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all next week. Bye, everyone.